This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2015, held at Faith Builders on August 4 through 7.
Something that Socrates has said. Socrates was a philosopher that we can learn some good things from. He, of course, made some mistakes in life and said some erroneous things. But one thing he said was, I cannot teach anybody anything. I can only make them think. So if we can ignite this thinking process, a child will teach himself. These concepts that I learned in astronomy weren't necessarily taught to me. I only have an eighth grade education. I don't have a degree in astronomy. But I have a keen interest in the things that I see in the universe around us. And so because of this, I've learned a few things, not a lot, but a few things about what we see in the universe around us. Lots of students have a negative stereotypical view of astronomy and some of the other sciences as well. And to them, it's, of course, boring. It's a drudgery to learn about it. They dread the class. But and oftentimes, all the people may remember about their astronomy class in school was that they learned something about a man named Ptolemy who thought the planets moved around the earth instead of around the sun, and they had some sort of complicated circular pattern called an epicycle as they moved around the earth. And then this man was followed by someone else called Aristotle, who was followed by someone else called Copernicus, and there was some other guy called Kepler and Galileo who did other things and made other statements. And then they had to learn all those constellations, and it was irrelevant. They didn't like it. Well, the reason astronomy stood out to me was, of course, a number of reasons, but one reason was because I was exposed to a few things that captured my imagination, got my little fresh mind rolling, and I was exposed to the wonders of the universe around us in a different way. So, is it possible that we can do this in the classroom as well with all the other subjects that we have to study? For example, I could go outside, I could take a child with me at night, and we could look up, if it would be in December in the evening time, we could look up, we could see Orion there. I could say, see Orion. Now, in the upper left shoulder, there's a star called Betelgeuse, and you see it's got an orange color, it's twinkling. And the child could agree. But I would only be stating the obvious, something he's seen all his life. So it wouldn't ignite his imagination. But if I were to go there and I were to point out Orion, which it's kind of hard to see it here now because of the lights, but we have the constellation Orion up here, and you should be able to see it in this area. And see if I can put the outline up. You can see the shape of the constellation here. The lower part of his body, the three bright stars of his belt. Up here's the club that he holds high above his head. Thank you for that. And then we have the supergiant star Betelgeuse right here. If I could focus in on this one star that seems to be insignificant and tell this child that that star there, if we could somehow get to it, if we could fly to it on a jet, which would take extremely long. It's almost impossible to do that because even if we were to fly much faster than the jet at about 186,000 miles per second, it would take from 7 to 10 lifetimes just to get there. But let's just say that we could get to this star and we get to the edge of this little twinkling speck here and we were to start at the center of it and if we could somehow fly, start at the edge and if we could somehow fly into the center of the star, how long would it take us flying at 600 miles per hour on a typical passenger airline? It would take, to complete this journey, would take about 50 years to get from the edge of it into the center. And so this is something that, of course, makes us think, wow, these stars must really be big. There's something out there interesting about these that is far exceeding the face value of the captivation factor that we have here. All right, so we'll move on and take a look at some other things that the scriptures are telling us. about astronomy. Psalm 19 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God." And it goes on to say, "The firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language where the voice is not heard." This tells us that regardless of where we are in the universe or in on this earth, we can see this message that God is trying to is showing us. And there are, of course, lots of men that notice these things. There are men longer ago that noticed this aspect of awe that God has placed in the universe around us. And they actually started to worship the sun, the moon, and the stars. Lots of the planets are named for ancient Greek and Roman gods. But this morning, we're only looking at this as a reflection of the glory of the true Creator. What you see up here is an actual compilation of images. This is not an actual view that you would have looking through space, but they're real images. And for that reason, you see the R logo down here. Now, this, of course, is a composite, which means there's a number of different pictures put together into one view. But these come from actual photographs, individual photographs, and I just put them together in one. For example, here you can see the individual photographs that I have here, Saturn, Uranus, or excuse me, Neptune, and part of the Omega Nebula, part of the Orion Nebula, and the Carina Nebula there, and they have just been put together into one view here. So there's lots of beauty in the universe all around us, and there's interesting things to look at. There's a message God has for us, and we're held accountable because of it. Romans 1:20 says, "For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." So this tells us that the message God is showing us through the creation and the heavens is profound and clear enough that we are held accountable because of it. If this message is important enough that it leaves us without excuse, I would suggest that it would do us good. It would benefit us. If it would be beneficial, if not imperative, that we take a close look at what God is revealing to us. In the beginning, God created the universe, the heavens and the earth. Everything that we see comes from this creative act in the beginning. Man has for centuries and for millennia tried to understand the nature of the cosmos and tried to understand where we came from, where we're going. We've been searching for the purpose in life, and we've been searching for the reason as to why we're here. There's been lots of different theories that have come from this. One of the most popular theories that have been for quite some time with secular astronomers, and of course it's fallen out of favor today, but for hundreds of years, astronomers and philosophers that didn't believe in God thought that the universe must have always existed, because they couldn't understand how that we could have a universe if there was no entity there to create it. And they didn't want to accept a creator, so they said that the universe must have always existed in eternity past. This was a variant of what's called the steady state theory. And so if the universe has always existed, there's no need for a creator. The universe in itself is a type of God. It's always existed. It's always been there. But as astronomers started building big telescopes and looking out across the universe, and they started taking starlight that's coming from stars and running it through a spectrograph or a prism, splitting it up to where that we could see all the different colors of light, see all the different wavelengths. They started gaining a wealth of information about the stars, their distances, their compositions, and their densities, and all sorts of things like that. One of the things that they were learning was that these stars are actually waxing old as doth a garment, just like the scripture says. They're running out of fuel. They're burning down and they're getting older. They couldn't have possibly existed in eternity past, because if they have a finite supply of fuel, if they would have existed for an infinite amount of time, they would have all burnt out today. So you see where we're going with this? the entire universe would have experienced what's called a heat death today, where that all heat would have dissipated from the universe after the stars would have all burned out, and heat would have dissipated across the known universe until the second law of thermodynamics would have caused everything to come to what's called a heat death. And today there would be no stars, there would be no heat left in the universe, basically no heat. We would have settled down to about 459 degrees below zero Fahrenheit as heat would have disappeared. But we're living in this universe where, actually on this Earth, where we have average temperatures that are almost 500 degrees above absolute zero. So we have all this heat. We can see all the stars shining around us. In fact, trillions of them. So this means that just sometime in the relatively recent past, these things were started up. They were given birth to. So the theory had to be revised. No longer would the steady state theory suffice. So there was a new theory. It was a step in the right direction because it actually conceded that the first phrase in the Bible was true in the beginning, but the secular astronomers stopped right here because they didn't like this. This was still a dirty word for them. So let's take a look at the new theory, which, like I said, is a step in the right direction, but it still falls short in explaining how things could have come about. It's called the Big Bang Theory. It's the belief that there was nothing and nothing happened to nothing. And then nothing magically exploded for no reason, creating everything. And then a bunch of everything magically rearranged itself for no reason whatsoever into self-replicating bits, which then turned into dinosaurs. So there you have it, the Big Bang Theory spelled out clearly. Now, if you look at the Big Bang Theory in detail, you study it closely, you see that there's lots of technical jargon there spelling out all the events that happened after the initial quantum fluctuation. And astronomers have it spelled out down to the nanosecond and femtosecond of how that energy appeared, or after energy appeared, and how that actually turned into matter and so on and so forth, and eventually stars and galaxies. But if you strip it of all that technical jargon, you look at it face value, you realize that it's the belief that there was nothing and nothing happened to nothing. Now, this is extremely difficult for me to get across here. The very beginning of this theory says that zero times zero equals countless trillions and quadrillions of everything. Now, this is a concept that I was taught in school is wrong. Even if we take zero times one, we still end up with zero. So here we have neither pre-existing cause nor pre-existing matter, yet we have this wonderful universe that's teeming with life. So, of course, this theory here is just because of the first step here, that initial quantum fluctuation, it falls flat on its face. Astronomers have been finding other problems with the Big Bang Theory that are far more technical and harder to dig up even than this problem here that I've just discussed. And because of that, there are some prominent astronomers that are deserting the Big Bang Theory and actually reverting back to the steady state theory, even though that's also improbable. But one of the issues of the astronomy magazine that I got in the last few years, it's a secular magazine, the headline on it was Hubble Bubble Big Bang in Trouble. Because of some of the revelations of the Hubble Space Telescope, of the universe around us, the way it works, the things we can see, astronomers are uncovering evidence that shows that the Big Bang couldn't have worked in the way they thought it could have. And so there are some prominent astronomers that are deserting even that theory. Now, there's there are problems with the Big Bang Theory, such as the horizon problem. I don't think we'll have time to cover that this morning. We may come back to that later. But the question is now, why do we as humans resort to things like this and such irrational, unreasonable explanation for the origin of the universe? Well, it's because we're prone to failure, we're human, and we make wrong judgments. This here is a test for us. It's a simple test. The first question here is, which square is darker? Is it A or B? And I want you to answer this in your own minds. You don't have to say it out loud because you might embarrass yourself. But here we, it looks fairly obvious that A is darker than B. This, the shade of this square is darker than this particular one here. But what I'll do here is I'll build a bridge across the distance between A and B, and you see how that it appears that they're about the same shade now. But some people, when they look at this, they say, yeah, well, it looks like we actually have a gradient here as we go from B to A, where it slowly gets darker as we travel across this bridge. The reason we tend to think that is because there's lots of things around here that are distracting or that are giving us the impression that that's the way it is, but it's just an optical illusion. I'll take everything off of the slide here except for those two squares in the bridge, and you see how they're exactly the same shade. Now watch closely as I back out of this. You can see how that, once again, we have A looking darker than B. But as we build a bridge, it becomes the same shade. So this tells us that our minds tricked us into thinking something that was entirely wrong. So can we trust our judgment all the time? Not always. Most of the time we can, but not always. To make matters worse, there's the God of this world that's continuously trying to cloud our judgment and make us believe things like the Big Bang Theory and others that are simply not true. Now, I don't know how God created. I don't want to be too hard on the Big Bang Theory. I know that God spoke. Who knows? It may have been a bang when He created. But I'm not getting into cosmological concepts like that this morning. I just want to make it clear that we as humans, for us, it is impossible through our own judgment to be able to discern the true nature of the origin of the cosmos. And we have a guidebook for life, though. It's called the Scriptures, the Holy Bible. And we wonder, what does that say about astronomy? So we'll look at a few things that the Bible has to say about astronomy next, and we'll see, does it harmonize with the universe around us? Job chapter 9, verses 8 through 10 says, "Which alone spreadeth out the heavens and treadeth upon the waves of the sea." Goes on to say, "Which maketh Arcturus, Orion, and Pleiades in the chambers of the south, which doeth great things past finding out, yea, and wonders without number." In verse 8, you notice how I have the word "spreadeth" highlighted. The reason for that is because that there appears to be something interesting happening in the cosmos that actually fits in with this scripture. I want you to hold on to that thought for just a little. He goes on and calls the stars and star clusters by the same name that we call them today, at least Arcturus, Orion, and Pleiades. Goes on to say that He does things past finding out, beyond our comprehension, and without number, beyond our ability to count. In Isaiah 40, verse 22, it says, "It is He that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in." This is another reference to the stretching out of the heavens around us. And there's actually lots of references to this in the Bible. There's close to a dozen references of this to this expansion of the universe. Astronomers noticed in the middle part of the last century that as they were looking out across the universe, they noticed that galaxies were actually moving away from us, and the farther they would look, the faster these galaxies were receding from us. So this told us that the very fabric of space, called space-time, is expanding, is carrying galaxies out with it. The framework of the cosmos is expanding, just like the Scripture says here, and God is expanding the universe. So here we see an element of truth in the Scriptures, like you see everywhere in the Scriptures, that actually sheds light on astronomy. Job chapter 26, verse 7 says, "He hangeth the earth upon nothing." This was written between 740 and 680 BC, which makes it at least 300 years before Aristotle first suggested that the earth might be round. Then it was another about 2,000 years later when Columbus was inspired to try to sail around the world. And about that time is when the general consensus of normal man thought that the earth must be round. But this was written even before Aristotle suggested that the earth might be round. And so, excuse me here, I got my a wrong slide here. But the earth is, that's coming later. Sorry about that. The earth here is supported by nothing. getting ahead of myself here. Let's cover this first before we get on to the round shape of the earth. The ancient mythology stated things like this, that there was a giant named Atlas that carried the earth about on his shoulders. And there was another mythology that was actually quite popular, believed by the Hindus, that the earth was supported on the back of four giant elephants. And then, of course, there was a problem. There was the question of what are the elephants standing on? And, well, evidently the turtle was important in Hindu mythology, so they decided the turtle is the perfect fit. Well, what's a poor turtle going to do under four elephants and a giant earth? Of course, he'll be crushed. Well, the obvious solution to this was let's just put him in a body of water where there's the compaction won't be a problem. And so the turtle's swimming through this giant body of water. Now we have our problem compounding to an even greater degree. What's to account for this giant ocean that the turtle is swimming through? So you see the problem when we reject the message of our Creator, when we resort to man's own explanations. But of course, we know, just like the Scripture says, that the earth is levitating with no support whatsoever. This is another proclamation from the Scriptures that was probably scoffed at by the contemporary philosophers of Job's day, just like they were probably scoffing at Isaiah for saying that the universe is expanding, because to the ancients it appeared that the universe was static. The stars stayed in their same positions, all except for the planets, which appeared to circle around across the background stars. And the moon and the sun, of course, did the same thing. Moving on, we see how that Isaiah 40:22 says, "It is He that setteth upon the circle of the earth." The earth is round. It has this spherical shape. It's not flat like men believed longer ago. We don't have to worry about sailing too far across the ocean's surface and falling off the edge like some explorers had that particular fear. So this, again, was written by Isaiah long before Aristotle first suggested that the earth was round. The rotating earth is spoken about in Job chapter 38, verses 12 and 14, where it says, "Hast thou commanded the morning since thy days, and caused the day spring to know his place?" Speaking about the earth here, "It is turned as clay to the seal, and they stand as a garment." The earth is turning, just like clay on a potter's wheel, or just like a rolling seal stamp over a sheet of clay. And so once again we have another illustration or another picture of the earth's behavior within the cosmos. The ancients thought that the entire universe orbited around the earth once every 24 hours. Today, of course, we know that the earth is turning within the universe once every 24 hours, giving the impression that the universe is actually orbiting around us. The number of stars is mentioned in the Scriptures. At a time when about 5,000 stars could be counted in the night sky, the following statement was recorded: "As the host of heaven cannot be numbered, neither the sand of the sea measured." Telescopes show us that this is true. If you go outside at night, you look up, at first glance it looks like it would be impossible to actually count the stars that are out there. But you could actually do it. If you have a good, dark, clear night, you can see about 3,000 to 6,000 stars. So the ancients could have counted the stars, but the Bible tells us that it's not possible. Today, with telescopes, we see there are many more stars than what we can actually see from our vantage point here without a telescope. We actually know that the number of stars is so large that if I were to tell you the estimated number of stars here this morning, it would be meaningless. We can't comprehend a number that big. So I'll just tell you how long it would take to count to that number. This comes from a book by, I think it was Stuart Burgess. I think the title of the book was, it slips my mind now, but a book by Stuart Burgess, who is a Christian astronomer. What we can do is we can take a cross-section of the universe, and we can count the stars in it through our high-powered telescopes. We can take that sample, and we can average it out with other samples in other areas of the universe. Once we have a good average number of stars in any particular area of the universe, we can extrapolate that number to account for all the stars in the universe all around us. And we can get a good estimate of the number of stars that are in our observable universe. Now, if we were to count to that number, of course, it's a big number, so we'll have to count fast. Let's just take the speed of my computer here for an example. I have, for those of you who understand technical jargon about computers, I have an i7 processor, which is one of the latest and greatest, fairly powerful processor. It can do about 2.2 billion calculations per second per core, so that equals to close to 10 billion calculations per second, which is pretty good for a laptop these days. Now, I'm not bragging over this laptop because, of course, it's got busted out keys and other problems, but I need to have a fairly good one to make sure I don't have problems when I give my presentations. So this laptop here, on the upper end of things, can make about 10 billion calculations every second. So we could reasonably assume that it could count 10 billion stars per second. So if we get it started here now, do you think we'd be finished by the time that I'm finished with the talk here? Of course, that depends on how long I go, but it would actually take much longer to get to that number of stars. According to what Stuart Burgess says, it would take 30 million years to count to that number at 10 billion stars per second. It's overwhelming. It's mind-boggling. It's earth-shaking. It messes with our concept of who we are, and it makes us realize we're not the center of the universe. Of ourselves. We tend to think that as we go through the world around us, everything is somewhat about us, and we just don't really concern ourselves with everyone else and everything else that's going on. But God has created so much out there around us that we literally cannot comprehend at all. Now, we also have a comparison between the stars of the heavens and the sand on the seashore. As the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is upon the seashore, as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. That's from Hebrews 11:12. The other was from Genesis 22:17. Astronomers today have found that the number of these two objects, stars and sand on seashores around the world, are actually comparable. The estimates of their amounts are very near alike. And so the scriptures, comparing them, is actually a little deeper than just a casual comparison. We measure time based on creation principles. One day is one rotation of the earth, as you see here. One month is approximately a cycle of the moon around the earth, one orbit of the moon around the earth. One year is one orbit of the earth around the sun, every 365 and a quarter days. Now, there's another major unit of time, measuring time, that we've left out. All three of these are based on celestial principles, actual matter doing things. But there is one that we have left that's not based on any type of astronomical phenomena. That's our week. And so where does our week come from? Where do we get that concept of a week? Well, in the scriptures, we have that 7-day work and rest period of creation. It's interesting that there is still a figment of that initial creation time that we are still observing today. There's no other significant reason for having a 7-day work and rest period as we still observe today. Matter and energy are constant. This is something that we realize from studying the first law of thermodynamics. It fits into this famous little equation, E equals MC squared by Albert Einstein. It's the most firmly established law in science. It tells us that the total quantity of matter and energy in the universe is a constant. If matter is annihilated, it's converted to energy, and vice versa. If energy is If we mess with it in a certain way, it'll be converted back into matter. But the total quantity of the two remain the same in our universe. Therefore, creation is constant and finished. Well, what does Scripture say about this? It says in Genesis 2, 1 and 2, thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them, and on the seventh day God ended His work which He had made. So the most firmly established natural law and science confirms this finished creation that the Scripture speaks about. There's fundamentals that we can look at in the universe around us. Science expresses the universe in terms of, number one, time, secondly, space, then matter, and energy. These four entities, everything around us is included in one of these four fundamental entities. What do we see when we look at the beginning of things in the creation account? Does the Scripture get the cart before the horse in creating things before these four fundamental entities are in space? Well, here we have it. In the beginning, time. God created the heaven, space, and the earth, matter. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, and God said, let there be light, which is energy. And there was light. And so here you have the four fundamental concepts of the universe, or entities, in the first three verses of the creation story. And then, of course, we see this continuation of order as creation progresses. And we see in verse 6, well, first there was light, and then there was water, and then verse 6, there was soil. Verse 9, I think it was soil in verse 9, and then finally plants in verse 11. And fish, animals, birds, and insects all have their survival traced back to the plant kingdom. And so naturally we would expect they were created after that was put in place, and that's the way it was. Then finally, once the grand stage was all set, God introduced man onto the scene as the pinnacle of His creation. Now the second law of thermodynamics is a very well-established law that states that everything in the universe is deteriorating, running down, and tending to disorder. Historically, most people believe that the universe was unchangeable, yet modern science verifies that the universe is growing old like a garment. Earth's rotation is slowing, magnetic fields are wearing out, stars are slowly burning out by consuming millions and even billions of tons of fuel every second. Our bodies are growing old and will decay into piles of dust. Machines wear down and break. So the second law of thermodynamics is something that we deal with every day. Thermodynamics is revealed in Hebrews 1:10-11, and thou, Lord, in the beginning hast laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of thine hands. They shall perish, but thou remainest, and they all shall wax old as doth a garment. So here we have the Scripture once again revealing an insight into the second law. This law is very well established beyond any dispute, yet evolution directly contradicts this law. Not just in some of the ways that we might think it would, but in other ways. Sometimes we have a misconception of the second law of thermodynamics, thinking that since evolution is saying things can get bigger and better, and second law says things have to wear down, that means that evolution couldn't be possible. But there are some ways that things can change into a more orderly entity or situation, even in the midst of the second law of thermodynamics. For example, if I myself, through my motions, arrange a table of marbles into a meaningful pattern, I'm defying the second law of thermodynamics. So in some localized areas, things can defy the second law of thermodynamics, but it takes energy to do that. And as energy is used up, this energy gets spread out into what's called entropy. And so eventually there is less and less potential for energy to be used to cause things like this to happen. So anyway, that's just a little primer on the second law. So Ecclesiastes 1:10 says, is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new, it hath been already of old time which was before us. Some of these discoveries of modern man are actually spelled out in the Scriptures. long before they were articulated or supposedly discovered by man. So this solidifies the Bible's authority on even these scientific issues. So yes, the science and the Bible do actually agree. There's a perfect harmony between the two. All right, for just a few minutes here yet this morning, I want to give you just a little primer into what we'll have tomorrow morning. I think I have enough time for it. What we'll do is start off with the general structure of the universe and see how it's put together. Most of us are familiar with this, but I want to just give you a run through it again here. First, we have the Earth in the first cube. The Earth is a small part of our solar system, which, of course, is comprised of the Sun being at the center and the planets orbiting around the Sun. The Earth is the third planet out from the Sun, right there. We see only a small part of the solar system in this cube here. It should actually be 20 to 30 times larger to include all the planets, but I'm limited for space here. Moving on, we have the solar system, a small part of the Milky Way galaxy, as you see here. Galaxies are groups of stars. Stars are arranged into clusters called galaxies. Then these galaxies are arranged into clusters of galaxies, like you see here. Then these clusters aren't just randomly scattered through space, but are actually in a congregation of other clusters. So this large-scale structure here is called a supercluster. It's a cluster of clusters. And lastly, as we move on out and look at the grand scheme of things here, we see that there is some type of a filamentary web of strings and voids of superclusters of galaxies that strings across space, as you see there. So there's a design there, regardless of what scale we look at. There's an incomprehensible size to the universe around us. But of course, the one that created it all is incomparably greater than the one than the things that we see around us. So since we have that little primer here, let's look at the size of these objects by simply comparing them with each other. Tomorrow morning, we'll take the Earth and shrink it down to the size of a quarter and move out from that to see how big the other celestial objects are in comparison to a quarter-sized Earth. Since these objects are so large, it's hard for us to comprehend their true size. So what I'll do tomorrow is shrink everything down and go at it that direction by using that analogy. But this morning, we'll just compare the objects to each other. Here we have the Earth, as along with Venus, Mars, Mercury, and Pluto, the dwarf planet Pluto. And as you see here, the Earth is the largest of these minor planets, also called terrestrial planets. They're the only planets with a solid surface, as far as we know. Moving on, we'll add the gas giants, and you see them here next to the circled planets that we just looked at. The Earth is circled there in the lower right, along with Venus, Mars, Mercury, and Pluto there. We've added Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Take a look at Jupiter, how much bigger it is than the Earth. It's actually 1,000 times larger in volume than the Earth. This means we could fill Jupiter with 1,000 planet Earths before we'd fill the volume of it. Moving on to the next step, we'll go to the Sun, see how large it is in comparison with the planets that are circled below the Sun. You see Jupiter there on the left. The Earth is just a black dot now at this scale. So you can see how much larger the Sun is than these planets. It's actually so big that it comprises over 99% of the mass of the entire solar system, which is the Sun, all the planets, all the comets, all the asteroids, all the meteoroids, the space dust in this disk. But the Sun is most of it by far. Most of that matter is bound up in the Sun. It's extremely massive. It's big enough that we could fill it with 1,000 Jupiters or with 1,000,000 planet Earths before we'd fill the volume of it. There's other stars that are much bigger than the Sun. It's because the Sun is what's called a main sequence star. It's in the most populous category of stars, kind of like an average star, even though it's more massive than most. So if the sun is somewhat of an average star, we would expect to see other stars even bigger than the sun, such as Sirius, Pollux, and Arcturus. We're leaving the main sequence stars here and getting out into the giant stars. Jupiter is about one pixel in size, just a tiny white speck at the end of the arrow, and the Earth is already invisible at this scale. But it doesn't stop here. There are other stars in a category called supergiants that we'll look at next here. We'll shrink down Arcturus to this size here. We have the Sun down here invisible, and we've added Rigel, Aldebaran, Antares, and Betelgeuse. Just completely incomprehensible. When we look at this star here on the right, Betelgeuse, sometimes it's pronounced Betelgeuse, but of course Betelgeuse is my favorite pronunciation ever since I was a young fellow. This star here is hard to comprehend, but this is the one that I pointed out earlier that would take us 50 years to travel from the outside edge into the center, 50-year journey across here. Another way to appreciate the size of this star is simply to take it and place it in an area of space close to us. We'll put it right in the center of our solar system, right there where the sun should be. This is the sun right here. This is the orbit of the first planet, Mercury. Out here is Venus. This is the Earth. We are almost 93 million miles away from the sun on average. And then we have Mars orbit, Jupiter out here. If we were to replace the sun with Betelgeuse, this is what would happen. It would be so large, it would completely encompass the Earth's entire orbit and move on millions of miles beyond us into space and even swallow up the orbit of Jupiter. So could you just imagine one day for example, right now in the evening, we can see Jupiter in the west. It looks like a star. Right now it's fairly low in the west, but earlier we could see it higher. So let's just imagine the sun at midnight when it's directly below us, if we're in the right part of the earth. If it were to start expanding, it would get larger and larger until it would completely fill that 93 million mile distance between the earth and the sun, would swallow the earth and extend up into the heavens and swallow that star Jupiter, the planet Jupiter, and go even farther than Jupiter. It's really amazing to think of this. Now, this star here is close enough to us that we can actually take the Hubble Space Telescope, zoom in on it, and see a disk. So we can use triangulation to see how big the star actually is and get a good definite estimate of the diameter of this star. Back to where we were here with the supergiants. I'll take you to one more category. It's a subcategory of the supergiants. It's called a hypergiant. And those here, we'll see one coming up in the background here. It's called VY Canis Majoris. It's about twice the diameter of Betelgeuse. Now, there's no meaningful words left to describe this star. The English language isn't good enough. It's not up to the task. Now, in my opinion, German gets it a little better when we can say this star is hässlich groß, but even that isn't adequate. All right, there was a few things that God was trying to show Job when he was sick, close to the end of Job's experience here. And one of the ways that God used to speak to Job, to minister to him, was to direct his attention toward the cosmos. Job 38:31, in the first part of the verse, says, "Canst thou bind the sweet influences of Pleiades?" And I see that I have gone over time here. Didn't realize that. I apologize for that. So I will just, you can study Job 38 tonight if you'd like to. Otherwise, we'll just have to wait until tomorrow to cover this. I think that's all I have, and we will give it back to the moderator. Thank you for your attention.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.